The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome, everybody. This is Kim Aaliyah, and I have on the phone with me Dr. Russell Malcolm and also Marcy Mearns, who will be assisting us towards the end of the call in terms of fielding people's questions that they might have. So let me go ahead and get started. First of all, let me just let everybody know that Dr. Malcolm will be offering a seminar, the only seminar in North America this year, between September 16th through the 18th in Washington, D.C. The seminar is entitled Resonances, Word, Voice, and Mind in Medicine. And you can see from the screen up here that this seminar will assist you in a variety of different areas, especially being able to improve your diagnostic precision, your speed and depth of history taking. It'll even help to deepen your understanding of each patient and many other things. This is also a seminar for which medical doctors can acquire one AMA CME credits, 2020 category one AMA CME credits. And this is a seminar that is only available to licensed practitioners, so you must be either a medical doctor or a nurse or naturopathic doctor, have some type of license to practice medicine. But we are fortunate enough to have on the call today Dr. Malcolm, who will be sharing with us some of his insights into what he'll be offering during this three-day seminar in Washington, D.C. So without further ado, let me go ahead and introduce Dr. Malcolm. So Dr. Russell Malcolm is the medical director of the Claremont Homeopathic Clinic in Glasgow, Scotland, and he's been practicing homeopathy for 20 years, including 6 years during which he served as the director of education at the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital. Since leaving that post in the year 2000, he has continued to contribute to homeopathic education both in the UK and internationally. And in addition to his medical homeopathic studies, Dr. Malcolm has studied the arts and humanities and has a long-standing interest in the performing arts. Over the last decade, he has drawn on all three disciplines, allowing art and science to influence his daily work in ways that have direct practical relevance to his patients, students, and colleagues. And if you want more information, there's a lot of things I could say about him. He's got a lot of credits and different titles. But if you want more information about Dr. Malcolm, you can visit his website, which is www.artscience.uk. So let me repeat that again, www.artscience.uk. science.me.uk. And there's also on the American Institute of Homeopathy website, which is where you can find out more information about Dr. Malcolm's event or Dr. Malcolm himself. You can visit that site by going to homeopathyusa.org. homeopathyusa.org. So, Russell, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're very busy. You've got a lot on your plate, and we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, fantastic. So, Russell, I thought perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about your background. You know, how did you actually get involved in homeopathy?
Well, I came into homeopathy almost by mistake. I graduated in 1982, which seems like a very long time ago now. And I started a hospital rotation almost immediately, doing quite, you know, heavy acute jobs in general medicine, pediatrics, surgery, and so on. I was a little way into that when I realized that, you know, it wasn't giving me everything I was looking for. I didn't feel as though my education was complete. And so I started an arts degree extramurally through the Open University in around about end of 1984. And by the end of 1985, I was looking for non-acute jobs that would allow me to immerse myself in different kinds of study and also to sit examinations and do dissertations and so on. And at the end of 1985, looking for this non-acute job, I saw an advertisement in the British Medical Journal for the Glasgow Homeopathic Hospital. And I applied for that job really knowing almost nothing about homeopathy, having never really encountered it in my medical training, and having only a vague memory of having perhaps been used to it or exposed to it as a child, and joined the staff as a senior house officer in 1986. So that was my start in homeopathy. It's 25 years ago. And since then, of course, I haven't really left the discipline. I have completed an orthodox training. I'm vocationally trained in primary healthcare, although I don't work in that area. After finishing at the Glasgow Homeopathic Hospital, I continued on doing part-time outpatient work with them. At that time, the inpatient unit had 30 inpatient beds and had outpatient departments in several locations in west of Scotland. And in the following 10 years, in fact, I spent a lot of time in these outpatient clinics learning the craft of acute and subacute and chronic prescribing. I was appointed as consultant in the hospital for a short time as a locum consultant in 1992-93. I took on a role in an AIDS hospice as a medical director of an AIDS hospice, looking after people at all stages of the illness around 1994. 1995, I took up the post of Director of Education in the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital and worked there for 6 years developing training courses, many of which are still running today. And since then, although I'm no longer Director of Education, I continue as a lecturer with them and continue quite a lot of involvement with the unit and internationally, mainly in a teaching role. I'm an examiner from the Faculty of Homeopathy as well. Does that help you give your background?
Yeah, absolutely. And Russell, I'm just curious, you individually, where did you get your training in homeopathy? And also, who have been your greatest influences as a practitioner of this art?
Well, in the 1980s, the Scottish faculty ran a modular course in homeopathy. And I sat in on that as a member of the team, of the clinical team. I also had a lot of clinical training with Hamish Boyd. To start with, I would sit in his clinics. I certainly learned a lot on the ward rounds. And ward rounds in homeopathy take an entire day. It's quite an interesting phenomenon if you've got 30 beds and you've got an individualizing role in the care of inpatients, plus an interdisciplinary discussion around dietary management or exclusion diets for those that were atopic, looking at investigation results and tying in homeopathy with other prescribing, often looking for strategies for reducing dependency on orthodox medication and utilizing complementary methods of pain control, symptom management in really quite a difficult client group. So these ward rounds were really quite an induction, and I reckon probably I learned a lot more sitting in the clinics and being a member of the junior team there at the Glasgow Homeopathic Hospital than I ever learned in any courses anywhere. Having said that, in the 80s and 90s, we had some fabulous teachers who were teaching under invitation from the Scottish faculty, Vitoukas, Asiaga, Jonathan Shore. They all taught in Scotland, and they were influential and very inspirational, and so there was a certain amount to be learned there as well. In the 1990s, I started to teach myself, and of course, with that, I had teaching trips to Prague and Romania and other former Eastern European countries, which were opening up. And of course, I learned a lot there as well. There's a lot to learn about how you communicate and about the different styles and cultures and heritages of homeopathic medicine, some of which had been in states of relative isolation and in some ways were in a rather purer state than some of the ideas that were evolving in Britain. So there's a certain amount to learn just purely from being exposed to international teachers in the 1990s. things, I think, are a little flatter now. We're now in a situation where we have one or two very high-profile teachers who circulate around everywhere, and there's a kind of hegemony and kind of flattening off, a little bit less diversity, I think, in the scope of ideas than there used to be, but that may just be a personal view. So that's where my training came from.
Very interesting. Russell, this coming September, you're going to be offering a seminar which is entitled Word, Voice, and Mind in Medicine. I was curious, could you tell us a little bit about what you actually plan to cover during this conference?
Well, broadly speaking, day one is words, day two is voice, and day three is mind. But these are obviously tightly interrelated areas, if you like, in our craft. As homeopaths, a lot of what we have to do is work with the spoken word. The spoken word is the vector for most of the information on which we base prescribing. And the way in which words and narrative are used are fundamentally important, as is the interface between our interpretation and the interpretation of our predecessors and their cases and their provings. And so we're working within a field of data which is extremely word dependent. And of course, to understand that is also to understand that there are a variety of problems in that. The first day will involve looking at words, looking at language, word data, how we model using words, we model our concepts using them, repertorial analysis technique, the effects of linguistics and culture on the models that we have on our perception. I'll be looking at issues around perception and how they're colored by language and how our illness models are constructed. Also, I want to include or look at medical bias, because the languages that we, and I'm using that word in a very broad sense, the languages in which we're taught have a great deal to do with our preconceptions, and those preconceptions involve areas of bias which can be quite problematic if what we're looking for is an open interpretation and a flexible, free, individualizing process. So it's a case of creating awareness of where medical bias and judgment and prejudgment arises from, aspects of belief, narrative, plotting of narratives, if you like. And on the second day, looking at the voice, aspects of tonality, expression, emotional dynamics, the prosody of the case, touching on vocal health and the way that the voice itself reflects illness, aspects of acoustics, refined listening practice, real-time skills, aspects of interviewer and practitioner performance, using analogies in music and arts and in literature, wherever appropriate. And in the third day, again, we're looking mainly in the mind realm, but the mind realm will be involved in the first 2 days as well, but in the third day, we'll be concentrating on cases where language, the psychology, the interaction, these performance skills of the practitioner, the prosody, the atmosphere, the avoidance of bias, word symbolism, narrative, visual perceptions, all these things come together. They all converge on the event, the therapeutic interview, to provide us with what we need for a successful intervention, homeopathically or otherwise. So that's the array. I mean, there's a lot of interdependent subjects here. I realize that some of you will be teachers yourselves, and if you have ever had the challenge of teaching a foundation course or teaching people about homeopathy from scratch, you've got a big jigsaw puzzle of interrelated topics. I once tried to draw out a conceptual map of first-year studies in homeopathy, and it looked like a spider's web. And trying to work out how things should be ordered so that that the concepts flowed and the narrative worked for the students was quite a challenge. There were certain things that had to be presented before other things. You can't talk about formulation until you've talked about potentizing, you can't really talk about potentizing until you talked about the emerging science of water and the structure of water and fractals and clathrate formation, and you can't talk about that unless you know a little bit about closed systems and about the emerging models in physics. And you can't really talk about that until you've actually presented where the sources of the materials have come from. And somehow you've got to talk about the symptom pictures, the qualitative interpretation of substances rather than mechanistic interpretations of them. So it's a network of subjects, and this seminar is a network of subjects as well. It's a spider's web of interrelated themes and ideas that somehow have to be knitted together and illustrated with cases to impart, I think, depth, scope and depth, and help people to get more out of the therapeutic interview and to expand their skills in the real-time art of medicine. So that's in broad terms what the seminar will be. I think many of these little parts of the jigsaw puzzles, they may only take 20 minutes, and I may be talking around a theme or an idea for 20 minutes, opening up the discussion, and then converging a variety of topics on a clinical case and showing how each of these elements are relevant in the real world to clinical medicine.
Very interesting. Now, it certainly sounds like a fascinating subject, and I myself am very looking forward to the conference. Maybe just specifically, in practical terms, what would a practitioner hope to take away from this seminar? In other words, how will it directly benefit their practice of homeopathy?
Well, what is a practitioner going to take away is, I think, more than anything, is some additional depth and experience, additional level of reflectiveness, additional level of mindfulness and of attentiveness. These things, I mean, we talk about them very glibly, you know, when we're talking about the therapeutic interview, but they don't come automatically. Similarly, you know, when we talk about intuitional prescribing, there's no such thing, really. Good prescribing is all based on knowledge and experience and on some kind of logical framework, some fabric of recognition, some ability to mirror complexity. And you're not able to mirror complexity unless you've engaged with complexity. And in some ways, that the idea is to come out of it with some kind of sublime simplicity, you know. When you've worked and struggled with certain things for long periods of time and you've identified the alphabet, then certain things should become free, liberated, and spontaneous. But you don't get to that level of spontaneity and freedom until you've actually engaged with the nuts and bolts. It's in the same way as, you know, if you were going to teach someone to draw a picture or paint a piece of representational art, until they've learned how to draw a line and create shading, until they've been taught the technical aspects of perspective, it's unlikely that they're going to be able to produce a good painting. Even abstract artists and people who are working with expressionist art, even they have to have some basic fundamentals of draftsmanship. And I really do believe that in homeopathy, we tend to educate from the back forward, and we tend to be a bit glib about, you know, empathy and about, you know, person-centered care and all these buzzwords, without actually really getting inside them and inside the concepts and inside what it actually means to be in that state, to be in the state of a practitioner who is fully signed up and committed to those ideas. So if you ask me what people are going to take away, it's going to be, I hope, a level of depth or a different level of engagement with the subject, with the techniques, a different level of self-reflection on what they do within the interview, probably a different pitch in terms of their level of attentiveness to smaller aspects of detail in the soundscape of people's voices, certainly a level of self-examination that will carry them forward to heightened abilities, I think. Those are the sorts of things that I would hope people would go away from. Inevitably, that inbound into the conference, there will be all sorts of ideas around prescribing methodologies and the timing of prescriptions and really quite prosaic things that we have to talk about if we're going to talk about treating people. So there will be aspects of nuts and bolts methodologies. One of the difficult things in homeopathy is purely working out the timing of prescriptions and working out in sequential prescribing when to act and when to sit tight. And those things emerge almost spontaneously and naturally out of any discussion around case management. But getting access into complexity in the case, being able to access it, model it, mirror it, understand the languages that allow you to do that, finding analogy, metaphor, finding the poetry in the case, all these things are part and parcel of the art of homeopathy.
Fantastic. Russell, I know that this is your conference in September is primarily geared towards homeopaths, but I'm curious, can also non-homeopathic practitioners participate in the conference, and what kind of benefits might they expect to get?
Well, I suppose that, I mean, it doesn't matter what discipline we come from. I mean, our object is to broaden our scope and evolve depth of understanding. And understanding, developing that depth of understanding is relevant to every clinical practitioner, anyone who's sitting in front of a patient, particularly a patient who's chronically ill, where they're struggling with evidence-constrained medicine or with struggling with the tools that have been delivered to them. In order for them to be able to make a quantum leap or to be able to engage a level of creative problem solving, they've got to have, you know, something else, you know, a hinterland or an ability to engage with the patient's context at a deeper level. And I think that that process, that learning process, that practitioner enlightenment is relevant to absolutely everyone. And everybody's on that journey, myself included. It's not a case necessarily of having answers for everything. And certainly I would be the last person to suggest that I have answers for everything. But I do have a certain, you know, having struggled with thousands and thousands of patients over these 25 years, I do have a certain sense of process and a certain insight into, if you like, the creative problem-solving things, the way of trying to work with both rationality and logic, but also working with things that are much more immediate, much more real-time, much more dynamic in the case. So if I was to suggest that this was relevant to other people other than homeopaths, I would say that inevitably, there will be certain things that are rather homeopathically based, particularly when we're talking about the nature of the data of proving and the language of provers and of the linguistic structures that have determined the repertory structure and where the pitfalls are in that. When we're talking about that, I imagine that there will be a peripheral relevance to clinical psychologists or psychiatrists or general practitioners. But certainly when we're talking about real-time engagement and we're talking about observation and we're talking about life contexts and narratives and mirroring things within our patient, I think these will be relevant to a very broad spectrum of practitioners. And I will be trying to bring in some of the aspects of modern thinking from neurophysiology and the medical sciences where they come to bear on that. So I hope that it has a wider relevance, although I must say it's an extreme challenge trying to make a conference all things to all people. And I'm not going to try and attempt that. I'm simply going to try and be fair to the subject and try and keep it clinically illustrated.
Very interesting. Russell, could you give us an example from your own practice where you've actually used these techniques? Maybe someplace where, you know, maybe it's helped you solve a case or something?
Well, obviously it's not realistic in here to actually give you a case, but in the conference I'm going to present a series of psychosexual cases. And I've chosen the area of psychosexual medicine because it embodies a lot of the things that we're talking about. These major catch-22s that people have with sexuality and emotions, relationships, these things all very tie very centrally into people's sense of self-worth, value, their self-perception and their self-image. There's so many other things that are hinged upon that. And when we're looking at psychosexual cases, we're often looking at etiologies, we're looking at narratives that have a long time frame, and we have a variety of things that are built into the patient's language and experience that are often quite hidden and sequestered in the narrative. So I'm going to present these cases that illustrate narrative that teaches about medical bias as well, because there's nothing like the belief systems of others and their sexuality to challenge, if you like, our own belief systems and our own moral codes. And if we're unable to get past our medical bias or our judgmental thinking in these cases, then the cases will be lost to us. They simply will not be cases we can help. Mm. Our primary object or our primary raison d'etre as practitioners is to alleviate suffering in the person in front of us, regardless of whether they're convicted criminals or whether we believe they've done things that are wrong or immoral or that are outside our scriptural beliefs or whatever. Those should be peripheral to the central business of engaging with them, understanding the center of their suffering, and helping them. So these cases illustrate the profound importance of keying into voice patterns, prosody, inflection, narratives, word symbolism, the meaning of language, the meaning of their language and how it reflects their experience, looking at the background context in their lives and working out what has become entangled from these experiences in their illness. So that's the reason why I've selected these cases. They've also got they've got length, they've got substance to them, and they help us to illustrate many of the other themes within the case. And they're also difficult to analyze. They're difficult to treat orthodoxly, many of them as well. And orthodox diagnostic labels like personality disorders or bipolar depression or these things become meaningless for these cases. They require something which is far more individualized, really, and to help them meaningfully. So the topics for all 3 days for word, voice, and mind will all be illustrated in these cases. I would hope that everything that we're talking about is seen to be relevant.
Very interesting. Russell, you know, in the description of your course, it's written, illness can arise not only from our biology, but also because of the way we think, react, behave, and live. And I was curious, could you explain this concept and specifically how it relates to the practice of medicine and particularly homeopathy?
Well, it's probably better to talk about what the other opposite is. You know, if you're not thinking about these people in these terms, if you're not thinking about them as dynamic entities, then you are thinking of them as diagnostic labels. You're thinking of them as management issues and problems. And in categorizing people into simplistic labels, you're then restricting your treatments to ideas that are often to do with management rather than change. You're often restricting your treatment ideas to quite manipulatory treatments. You're often looking at symptom management rather than resolution. And if you are limited in that way, there's a huge scope for healing that is being lost in medicine. And the way that you can get past that, the way that you can get past treating people as a series of management issues or treating diagnostic labels, moving away from over-mechanistic, over-circumscribed diagnostic models, is to look at life context and try and understand the pathography of the case. Pathography is an old-fashioned term that comes from 19th century medicine that has to do with tracing the evolution of illness in the individual. And human beings are uniquely interesting in that our personalities, our belief systems, and our emotional life evolves throughout life, and it evolves in ways that really mean that we are entirely different individuals at the ends of our lives as we are than from the ones we are at the beginning, although we can find that we get stuck within patterns that are quite pathological in terms of our mental emotional patterns, our belief systems, aspects of memory, aspects of association, response patterns, and habits, if you like. So, you know, looking at the pathography of the case, it's quite clear that all the various influences become entangled in the final outcomes, you know, the etiologies, the consequences, the reactive consequences of life events, our compensatory measures that we have psychologically or physically, they become entangled and they become pathological, and they drive us into doing certain things, drive us to overwork or drive us to drink or drive us to forms of addiction or dependency or drive us into patterns of behavior that are self-fulfilling or self-repeating, representing aspects of pathology, entrapment, a lack of liberation, if you like, and an inability to engage with change and with a healing pathway. So if we're looking at these things homeopathically, we're suddenly finding that the narrative, the understanding of the biological aspects, understanding of etiologies, the understanding of evolving ideas, fixed belief systems, aspects of behavior and reaction all become relevant. They help us to model the case. They help us through this process of pathography to model the person that we have in front of us. And from that, we are able to find new solutions for helping them. And homeopathy is fundamentally about change. It's fundamentally about taking a pattern which has got its cycles of self-maintaining illness and actually helping people find their way out of that. And you don't find that with a drug or with a diagnostic label usually. I mean, sometimes you do, and there are no prizes for missing a fundamental diagnosis like cancer or TB. But from the vast areas of human experience, vast areas of human suffering, the answer isn't in the label. It's in the context. It's in the backdrop to the person's life, and the solutions lie there too. So I think that's where that concept comes from. I mean, so that's how it relates to the practice of medicine.
Russell, continuing on the same theme, a little bit later on it's written, we will discuss the use of words to convey life context and time-sensitive meaning in addition to the well-understood elements of narrative, sensations, beliefs, and emotions. And this is kind of what you've been touching upon. Could you give us some examples of how specifically this could help in the selection of a homeopathic remedy, for example?
Well, I think if you're looking at what I will do is I'll introduce cases at different levels of depth. So, for example, I'll introduce some simple cases that have a single etiology that are tipped over into an acute state, whether it's aconitum or jalapa or belladonna or, you know, elanthus state, that they're stuck in for long periods of time. They stay recognizably in that state. They don't acquire blocks to cure, and they don't complicate, or the problem doesn't grow arms and legs, and they remain sensitive, sometimes even years afterwards, to the same remedy that was relevant at the time of the acute etiology. And these are, if you like, single etiology, single-stranded cases with no blocks to cure. And I will try to evolve and provide examples of cases where two etiologies have become entangled. They've either converged together or they've been concurrent at a time of a patient's life to create a much more complex pattern. And of course, those cases sometimes have got acquired blocks to cure. Sometimes they acquire secondary disturbances, whether there's emerging food intolerances or bowel dysbiosis or allergies or, in fact, a drug regime which keeps them stuck. And so these cases can have several etiologies, can have several strands, can have several blocks to cure, and can become chronic in a way that requires us to be able to model the case differently. And you're only able to understand a case, you're only able to model the case if you're able to see the etiologies in the narrative, if you're able to see how the etiologies and the symptom picture has evolved over time, if you're able to track how the patient has accumulated blocks to cure and how that's represented in the symptom picture, and if you're then able to then model the case and its various entanglements, you can then see how to unpick the case. You can then see how to remove blocks to cure, how to resolve maintaining forces in the case, and then to give a well-chosen similia that address the primary causes or the resonances from the primary etiologies. So there is that aspect. If we're talking about time-sensitive meaning, we're looking at life context, we're looking at being able to model the case appropriately. And we can only model the case by looking at examples of cases that are starting off with uncomplicated single-stranded cases and working our way up to really quite complex multi-stranded, multi-etiology cases with multiple blocks to cure. And these methodological aspects can transform our ability to succeed in chronic case management. If you don't treat the case, if you don't remove blocks to cure because you don't perceive them, then even the best chosen remedies will fail. And certainly in my early days, before I was equipped with the models for disentangling complexity in the case, many of my prescribing outcomes were quite disappointing, quite simply because I wasn't switched on to the different strands that were running in the case. And I will use analogies in music of the simplest song up to the more complex abstract symphonies to try and to help people to get a handle on the concept base for that particular idea. But again, central to it is the idea of words and how they're presented within the narrative and what meanings they have within the emotional expression of the patient and what are still living consequences in the case when we see them now as opposed to when they were first presented. I don't know if that's clear or not. It's a complex thing.
Absolutely, Russell. And I'm curious, Russell, in some of the things that's written about your work, there's some terminology which perhaps some of the participants on today's call may not be familiar with. So I was hoping perhaps you could clarify what you mean by the following concepts, and I'll just read them off. There's a number of them here. Number one is this thing that you refer to as the wordless case. Number two is the obfuscating case. Number three, this idea of word symbolism and metaphor. And then the fourth item is word choice and the homeopathic repertory. So if you could perhaps give us an idea of what these various concepts mean, I think it would be very useful to the participants. First one being the wordless case.
Well, I'm sure that all our participants have got examples of wordless cases. I mean, your child with autism, or I'm going to present, I hope I've got time to present a child with autism who's only got, who's only able to string together, words in pairs or in threes. Or I have a case of a child with developmental and social retardation that I'd like to present as well, where you're not going to get a history from the patient. You're not going to get their narrative, and yet there's a lot of information in the case. Case of speech delay and hearing deficits, another one where a child has no speech and has a hearing deficit and who is presenting their priorities using visual cues. have a case of a fugue state where there's the patient has stopped speaking altogether, and there's no meaningful communication, which again has lots of other contextual information that allows us to solve the case. Cases where there are behavioral and visual cues are important. Of course, many of you who have been exposed to fine teachers like Jonathan Shore will have watched his videos and seen how the remedy expression can exist within the behavior of the patient. And this is a well-known aspect, but we have to be switched on to those things. So there are lots and lots of lots of examples of the wordless case. There's lots of cases that require a treatment using rubrics that are full of words and using proving cases that are full of words, and yet the patient themselves isn't going to give us anything that.
And Russell, you include infants and animals in that category as well.
Yes, I include animals in that category as well.
Yeah.
Perfectly amenable to homeopathic treatment. Certainly our homeopathic vets have got wonderful cases that they can present, but I'm not in that field, so I will not be presenting any animal cases. But I might just present one by analogy, who knows. The obfuscating case, I think I will again, within the psychosexual case studies that I'll be showing, there are a number where there is significant undercurrents of guilt in the patient themselves, and this creates a whole variety of diversionary phenomena in the narrative: apocryphal stories, detractors, various fables, and various other ways of steering away from the central point or the central emotion. It doesn't, of course, just happen in psychosexual cases. It can happen in any case where there's a degree of suppression or an unwillingness to engage with the really central problems, where there are taboo areas, and those taboos they represent a form of impasse. They represent a block to change in the patient. They represent the uncommunicating or uncommunicable, unspoken sources of suffering. If they're not penetrated, then the patient will not change. You will still be prescribing for their migraine headaches 10 years later. You'll still be prescribing for their insomnia or their mood disturbances. So we've all been faced with cases where the central problem is a dark hole, is a dark spot. It sometimes, of course, is a dark spot to the patient themselves if there's a significant lack of insight, but often it's not. It's often a case where there's an obfuscation or a hiding or hidden dimension to the patient. And it's quite important, in my view, not to be invasive to these things. I have known practitioners who've been really quite aggressive in trying to penetrate these dimensions in the patient's mind, and it's a form of abuse, in my view. There are ways of encouraging these problems and dark corners into the light without necessarily challenging your patient to reveal things when they're not ready. But I will attempt to look at cases where they're not obvious, they're not clear, because the patient themselves is hiding stuff from us. And yet, in these cases, there's so much other contextual information that we can usually make sense of it, and we can usually recognize the remedy image as well. So that's the obfuscating case. The word symbolism and metaphor are just terms that relate to some of the tools that I'm going to be talking about. I would like to talk a little bit about how life experience is distilled in arts and in poetry. Quite frankly, for many people who are working in medical science, the idea that a poem is relevant to clinical medicine would be a completely foreign idea. They keep their art and their ideal of literature or poetry in a completely separate box from what they consider relevant to medicine. And yet, if you're looking at the connection between rationality and emotion, if we're looking at the distillation of human experience into a small time frame, the representation and the mirroring of it, then the poetry and literature can be ideal ways of learning. And if we look, I will bring into the seminar the idea that words, symbolism, metaphor, analogy, poetry, literature, these things can help us to construct meaning in not only in our own lives, but also to identify aspects of meaning in our cases and our patients. When it comes to word choice in the homeopathic repertory, I mean, that will be aspects of data handling, and I would like to talk about how the repertory has evolved, because there are some severe shortcomings that relate to a misunderstanding of linguistics, a misunderstanding of how we order thought and rationality, which has meant that some primary data has been corrupted in our construction of our repertories. It's far too complex to talk about just now, but I will want to talk, particularly in day one, about the difficulties of homeopathic data and in terms of the tools that is presented to us, because it can be a source of prescribing failure in us. So I will talk about repertory language and constructs in the repertory, but I don't have time, obviously, here to talk about that.
Yeah, sure. And Russell, do you use most of the Bunninghausen therapeutic pocketbook now, or are you using Kantian repertories or combination, or what is your emphasis?
Well, in my own work, I take from the case not only the narrative and the symptomatology, but I also evolve from the case the method of analysis that's required, because quite clearly the different cases that present to us require entirely different methods of analysis. And the case that requires, for example, a Shalton group analysis method is going to be an entirely different kind of patient to a patient who requires a Kantian totality. And that patient is going to be an entirely different case that requires an analysis method that uses Bunninghausen's pocketbook. The real secret to success is understanding what it is in the case that shows you what analysis method is most appropriate for the simillimum. And it's important not to analyze all cases using one algorithm or one analysis method or one analysis tool. I use a very broad array of analysis techniques in my work. I will use Kent and or Kent-derived repertories. I'm extremely attached to Bunninghausen's pocketbook and polarity analysis, and I think there's a lot of room for expansion there in the data available to us through that route. But I will also use other forms of analysis. I will use three-legged stool sensations techniques, although not the Sankran methods, but other sensations methods. I'll use keynote rubrics from time to time. I'll use forms of group analysis, including Shalton's method from time to time as well. The real secret is knowing what cases to use what method in, and being able to move flexibly and freely between the method and not being stuck in one. If you're using Shalton and you've got a case who really needs a plant remedy in front of you, you can just simply forget it. You get lost among the trees.
Good analogy. Hey, Russell, I'm fascinated by your emphasis on how voice reflects changes in well-being. Can you explain how specifically voice quality, pitch variability, and even real-time spectrographic analysis are used to investigate characteristics of the voice? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, obviously, we're all picking up fine signals from voices all the time. I mean, particularly if we're working with people a lot and we're listening, spending an hour in conversation with them, we are becoming more and more attuned and more adept at understanding what the voice is and what is being presented by the voice. Clearly, anybody who's speaking is presenting not only the verbal, rational line, but is also presenting us with a whole variety of emotional interpretational stuff, a variety of dynamic things. And the dynamics of the case, and the dynamics even in when they're associating their present with their memories, the dynamics of the voice are reflecting their emotional content to that. And it's, again, it's a bit like a piece of music playing. There's particularly a piece of vocal music. You've got the text running, but you've also got a lot of harmony, you've got motifs, you've got a whole variety of other things that are working within that soundscape. Obviously, the voice can present you with, you know, with changes that occur with cardiorespiratory disease and with asthma, and you know, you can often tell how well a patient is purely by what their voice is doing. And there are some very, very, you know, basic fundamental aspects of vocal physiology that we will tie into when we're assessing a person's health. But there are lots also of extremely fine nuances in the voice. And having an understanding about pitch and about variability, about fundamental frequencies, being able to recognize these things is quite important. And I'll certainly be showing cases where the voice, in terms of its rhythms, its tempo, its inflections, and its even its phrasing can reflect very strongly what the current state is in the case. So there will be two cases particularly that I present at the Congress where the voice is so fundamental to the final analysis that if it's not tuned into quite carefully, then you actually miss a very, very important piece of prescribing data. When we're looking at these tools, the real-time spectrographic analysis, if we're looking at the various you know, things that we can use visually, I do see them only as tools. They're not, you know, if we're, there will be amongst us extremely qualified and extremely experienced people who can hear all the various finest nuances and understand how these translate into repertorial terms. They can understand the patient who's hoarse or who's prattling or who's hissing, who's sibilant, who's got disturbances of prosody, who's speaking quickly or slowly or hesitating. They can find these rubrics easily and can understand the relevance of the remedies inside the rubrics to the case. But there are also people who are not yet tuned to the patient. And sometimes if we use visual means, we can help people tune in to what's going on in real time. You know, so presenting spectrographic analysis, presenting real-time recordings, presenting things on a stave or presenting kind of tempo markings for the patient's speech or looking at visual representations of what's going on in their phrase structures, showing the difference in the prosody of people who are in a mineral mindset versus the plant or the animal realms can help people understand or can orientate themselves to the case. And there's an awful lot going on. You know, there's a huge amount going on in the real-time experience of a patient sitting in front of us. And the more information that we can gather in real-time, the more we're practiced in being able to tune into that real-time data that's flowing past us. The more we can ground in that, then the more quickly we'll be able to establish a proper mode of analysis, understand the patient's case, understand their internal emotional milieu, be able to mirror them appropriately, and be able to convert their inner experience into repertorial language and repertorial terms, and or analyze the case. Fundamentally, everything we're doing comes from the patient, comes from the living case. That's where our data comes from, and it comes to us in real time. So any technique that can be used to refine the ways that we capture that or catch it and model it is useful. And as I say, these things, the spectrographic analysis and these various tools are only transitory things to help people who are starting out get a grip on all of the main concepts so that they have a heightened level of awareness of what's going on in real time. Does that answer the question?
That's great. That's great, Russell. I'm gonna open up the call to let some other the other participants ask some questions in just a few moments. Okay. For those of you who do have questions, You won't be able to speak, but if you look in your control panel, there is a place where you can type in your questions. Feel free to go ahead and type in any questions that you have for Dr. Malcolm, and just in a few moments we'll field some of those questions and relay them on to Dr. Malcolm for him to answer directly. Before I go ahead and open up the lines to do that, Red, you can go ahead and ask your questions now if you'd like. I just wanted to ask you one more question, which is if there's anything else you'd like to add about your upcoming class, or course, or anything about your work in general that you wanted to share with us, I think this would be a great time to do that.
I wouldn't even know where to start on that.
And you got to do this in 2 minutes or less.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of things happening at the moment. I am working on a whole variety of things that I hope will actually be part of the final seminar, including a work on all Bunninghausen's rubrics from the therapeutic pocketbook, translating them into usable, practical questionnaires that help to guide good focused analysis. So there will be a variety of things that I'm trying to tie together. I must admit, the Congress, even though it is drawing on many seminars that I've given in the last 10, 15 years, is quite a challenge because in order to really, I suppose, make it relevant to a broad array of practitioners and to make it something which is truly accreditable, it means that the subject areas seem to be quite diffuse, and yet the Congress itself has clearly got to be practical and has got to improve skills. And I just find that it's quite a challenge to bring together all these ideas into one space. But I hope that I will succeed.
Fantastic. I'm sure it's going to be a fantastic seminar. So, Marcy, are you on the line? Are there any questions that have been posed for Dr. Malcolm?
You know, this is a question I had as well, so I want to thank the person who put this forward. What is the best way to learn about which repertory or which methodology, perhaps better said, to use in an individual case? If you have any suggestions for those of us who are still trying to come to that place.
Well, when we're looking at this is engaging several different concept areas from the seminar that I'm actually going to talk about. The way that primary etiologies present in the symptom picture and how much that is modified will often determine whether you're looking at a resonance from a long-term resonance from an acute remedy, and many of them will be plant remedies. The level of physiological activity in the case or instability in the case will often be reflected in the kind of prescribing field that you're dealing with. The narrative itself and the way the prosody of the patient is presenting it will often tell you whether in fact you actually need to have quite a rational, constructional approach to the case analysis, or whether it needs to be much more flexible or fluent. So a patient who is giving you an extremely rationalized case with in chronological order and who's on a kind of fixed rail in the way the narrative unfolds, those patients will be in some ways asking from you quite a rational approach to the analysis. Many of them, of course, will require mineral remedies, although not all of them. It's impossible really to put this down to simplify this, because there are several areas that are going to come together. Once I've described what repertories are in terms of how they're constructed and where the pitfalls lie, once I've looked at the aspects of language and what it means in the context of individual cases, once we've looked at the narrative and how it's flowing and what the prevailing emotional content is in the case, once we've looked at the balance between structural deterministic fixed aspects and very unpredictable, dynamic, unstable aspects, then it will be much easier for us to identify how you analyze the case, the route towards the analysis of the case. Basically, the route to the analysis of the case comes out of what kind of case it is, and what kind of case it is reflected in what kind of history it is that you're given. And that has to do also with how you model the case, what your understanding and conceptual basis for that case. I haven't got a source text that I can suggest that gives you the different ways of analyzing the case. I have thought about trying to create a diagram that gives you some basic ideas about how to make decisions around case analysis. One of our real difficulties is that in the world of homeopathy, a lot of teachers are on a kind of single platform in terms of the methodology. If you listen to Vitul, because he's now talking about layers of health, he's talking about remedy essences. If we're looking at Shalton, the periodic table, we're looking at kind of two-dimensional reduction of life themes being played out in two dimensions. If we're talking about Sankran, we're looking at, again, an algorithm, which is a form of categorization based around models for what the materia medica means, if you like. And very often our teachers are teaching one method and are compressing or giving us the impression that their analysis techniques are all encompassed by that method. Quite clearly, you know, we need to be a bit more flexible than that, in that many of these methods have got useful components that are relevant to specific sorts of cases. And it's our challenge to work out which cases are amenable to what methods. And the information is all there in the history and in the way the case presents. But it's beyond me to be able to reduce that to a simple answer just now. I would hope that by the end of the Congress in September, you have got some pretty good ideas about the route that you will take to case analysis for any given presentation. But it's a bit more complex than I can ground, and I would hate to try and turn it into a single-line formula, because inside every formula is a delusion. Every time we try and create one hard-lined black-and-white methodology, we're also failing ourselves, because it represents a delusion that can never cover the panoply of human experience. So, you know, one of the reasons for doing a congress like that is to loosen up ideas and to make them flexible and patient-orientated again, and not allow us to be driven by an over-mechanistic or sort of a protocol for the way we analyze or interpret the case.
Fantastic. Marcy, I think we have time for just maybe one more question.
Sure. Can you clarify for us? Yeah, sorry. Are you hearing me now, Kim?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hello. Okay, sorry about that. Hi. Can you clarify for us, when you're talking about aspects of the voice in symptoms, is this in some way a specialization, if you want to call it that, in recognizing the characteristics of the voice, or how does that fit into the overall work of what a prescriber might do?
Well, I mean, the voice is extremely interesting because, of course, it is so dynamic. It is also actually quite highly structured, and everybody's voice can be modeled fractally into a unique fractal pattern. So our voices are unique as our fingerprints. The problem is translating the uniqueness of the voice into something which is repertorial and or analyzable. I think really in keying into the unique aspects of the voice and understanding the voice as a fingerprint and understanding that the totality of the case is sometimes reflected in the voice, just in the way that some other cases present their totality in the color of their skin, or present the essence of the case in the movements of the limbs. The voice itself can be a very important presenter of the constitution, or if you like, the essence of the case. But entangled with that is the voice as a vector for information, the voice as a reflector of pathology, a voice as a reflector of mood, and being able to tune into that and having an understanding of that, I think it should be part of our toolbox. I don't necessarily see it as being specialized. I just see it as being another component in good homeopathic training. There are many, many things, there are many components that should be inside our educational training as physicians, not necessarily as homeopaths, but as physicians. And being able to understand the case, not only in rational terms, but in terms of experience or mirroring or dynamics, those are important skills. The thing about orthodox medicine is that because they put static labels on things all the time, we tend to lose the importance of the dynamics, and we end up with the label as being the rationale for treatment or for case management. In homeopathy, the opposite is true. The dynamic of the case is the thing that we're trying to mirror. It's the dynamic of the case that it has to be understood in its complexity and mirrored by the complexity of the remedy. And the dynamic of the case is presented through the dynamics of the case, which include the voice, which is a very, very dynamic phenomenon. And it's just another aspect that we need to be able to understand and capture through training, really. So I'm not sure whether that answers the questioner's question. I don't see it as a specialized thing. I see it as an essential part of what we do.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Malcolm, thank you so much again for a fascinating discussion, and thank you to everyone who took your Saturday morning out to join us on today's call. Again, if you are a licensed practitioner, you can attend the upcoming conference between September 16th through the 18th in Washington, D.C., and hopefully we'll have Dr. Malcolm back again for future webinars. Thank you again to everybody, and Dr. Malcolm, Marcy, thank you so much for your help, and wishing everybody a very good rest of your weekend.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.